Maybe there'll be some kind of a global dictatorship where the US of Trump comes together with Putin and Xi or something like that, and then which is a unification in a sense, really from top down. But then in 2031, I think there will be a, because of that particular wave, there will be a reaction against all this control and so forth that is being developed by many parts of the world as the current time. And then people would react to it and free themselves and recreate a new world in a sense.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Mind the Shift. I am Anders. Today, I'm excited to be able to talk about how everything started and how everything works. My guest today is Carl-Johan Kallemann, a fellow Swede who lives and works in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Welcome to the show, Carl-Johan.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you.
Or is it CJ, perhaps, over there?
No, you could, Carl. I usually go by Carl.
Okay, that's how what people call you there. So Carl-Johan is, of course, a common Swedish name. You have dedicated most of your career to studying the ancient knowledge of the Mayans, in particular their calendar, their very advanced calendar, and you've written 8 books on the subject. But you are originally a trained biologist and chemist, right? So tell us how you began delving into the Mayan world.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, I got my PhD in Stockholm University. That was in 1984 in a topic called physical biology. And I worked for about 20 years then with cancer research based on knowledge of chemistry and biology. And the first 10 years in Sweden and then 10 years at the University of Washington in Seattle, Department of Environmental Health. And then came a point where a lot of changes took place in my life around 92, 93, and I had already taken up an interest in the Maya for various reasons. I did go there to on a backpacking trip in 1979 already, and got familiar and very much fascinated and in love with the Mayan people and their ways of being and thinking, and also studying the ancient Maya and the Maya that produced a very advanced calendar system that largely is gone today. But anyway, that sort of stayed with me from 1979 when I had that first encounter, going both to Mexico and Guatemala. And then in 1993, things turned in a different direction, you might say. And I think I took up what was really the purpose of my life, what I really was meant to be here for. And that was to make sense of the calendar system of the Maya, to make it comprehensible to modern people. And that's what I started then. And basically, I've been doing that ever since, even though occasionally I might have taken some teaching job in chemistry or so. But I used to wonder how come not everyone is interested in this, since actually the calendar system does have a lot to say about everything, as you said initially, and what we're here for, and I have mostly wondered why not everyone is, but anyway, that's the fact that it that not everyone is. And to me, it just became a calling. It's something that I had to do if I wanted to manifest what I was here to do.
Yeah. Fair question. Why isn't everybody interested in these deep questions? Want to ask about the documents or the scripture, the texts that have been left from the ancient Maya. As far as I understand, there are not very many books left. I think three or something. And Popol Vuh is one of them, the most famous, I suppose. And then there's the calendar. Or is the calendar described in these books, or is it something different? What is what here?
Yeah, right. Yeah, there are four books remaining that have been found that are from pre-colonial times. And then there is the Popol Vuh that was written down in the early 1700s, both in Spanish and in the native language. And then there is a huge body of inscriptions in stone at the various sites in the Mayan sites where they used to live or make ceremonies and such things. And then there is the very fact that at least one aspect of the calendar system, which is what they call the sacred calendar of 260 days, that has survived through the conquest by the Spanish and then up until the present time. And all of this has sort of served to create a consistent pattern that we call the Mayan calendar. There really isn't any one stone or something like that you could call the Mayan calendar. From the Aztecs, which came later and became the major empire before the Spanish conquest, from them there is a big stone, the calendar stone, and sometimes that's used as a symbol for the calendar system. But it's not really a complete picture, and it's really not Mayan either, but it's certainly related to that. The whole region, even if they belong to other peoples like Toltecs, Aztecs, Zapotecs, etc., the whole region basically followed the same structure of thinking when it comes to calendars. And it's notable that the four surviving books to this time that we know of, at least, they're all calendars. And so you may suspect that all their books were calendars, and that's kind of funny from our perspective if we would go into a bookstore today and everything were calendars. But who knows? That's what I guess, though, that at least it played such a big role in their lives that everything would be looked upon through that particular calendar. Yeah. And today, I should say that, every day there is a day sign and a number. Today it is seven serpent. And so what that means is that those two symbols, the number seven and the serpent, they capture something of the essence of the energy of this of today. And it goes on like that. And then you have much longer time periods as well. And they are also described by certain energies that capture their essence. And from this comes a worldview where everything is determined really by energies of time.
Mm. When I first encountered New Age, or maybe when I first learned about the what we call the New Age ideas of where humankind is heading, this was the first time I ran into this was, I guess, in the 70s, but more seriously, maybe in the 90s. There was talk about an ascension into a higher dimension, and there still is that kind of talk, as you know. And I remember the years 2010 to 2012 were pivotal. They were mentioned a lot, and it was kind of difficult to wrap your mind around what that entailed. But through your deep studies and your book, The Living Universe, which I just read here, the latest of your books, you offer a clear explanation for what this is about. It's this ascension, as far as I can understand, and correct me if I'm wrong here, it's the last wave of consciousness. And according to the Mayans, the universe has undergone 9 of these pulses or waves of consciousness, each with a higher frequency than the one before. Is this a fair description of the basics of what they're teaching us?
It is a very good description, and that it's the basics. I could share my screen.
Sure, please do.
And so what you have here to the left of the picture is a pyramid. It's made based on the pyramid of the plumed serpent in Chichen Itza in Mexico. And as you can see there, it's built in 9 levels. And that's the cosmology of the Maya in a short form, you might say. And each of these levels is dominated by some state of consciousness. And that's what you see to the right there. You can see the faces, and some of them has filters and some kind of geometrical structure. And those, you might say, shape the people living in those particular time periods, living under the effects of these particular waves. And as our consciousness is shaped by these various states, we humans act differently, or we create differently, so to speak. And then there is a certain precise timing as to when these different states of consciousness have been activated. And if you can see at the bottom there, you're actually looking at the 5th of these waves. And then starting 100,000 years ago, which really is when humans took the step from being animals to being something more, when they started to express themselves as, artistically, symbolically, and so forth.
And then there was 100,000 BC, according to the Mayan calendar.
Yeah. That's right. And then you have the various other activation times to the right there for when a new wave is activated. And then when the new wave is activated, a new state of consciousness is downloadable, maybe is the best way of saying it. And as that happens, the world changes because human creativity changes. The human mind simply changes. The human mind is essentially downloaded to our brains, and together they form a new human, so to speak. And then, that's exactly as you were saying, and it all leads up to that 9th wave that was activated fairly recently, then 13 years ago, and which basically is a return to the kind of unity, unfiltered state of consciousness, as you can see there.
So this which was present before the 5th wave, or before the 6th wave?
No, they all they're activated on top of each other. So the 6th wave is only activated when the 5th wave had come fairly has developed what it should develop fairly much, and then on top of the 6th wave, which brought the civilizations with pyramids and with the cities and so forth, starting 3115 BC. And then on top of that, in 1755, comes the 7th wave, which is the Industrial Revolution. And then 8th wave, 1999, that's a digital revolution. And then it's the final one, you might say the highest state of consciousness, in the sense that it's an unfiltered unfiltered, unstructured state of consciousness that allows for the experience of a complete unity. And in that sense, you might say that it's the highest state, I would say.
That's truly fascinating. And the year 2011, I think many people have they're familiar with this trope around the December 21st, 2012, yeah. Which supposedly was the end of the Mayan calendar. But you're here talking about 2011. I concur that 2011 was a very, very eventful year. I was working as a news journalist at the time, and there were so many things happening during that year. It's the Arab Spring and the tsunami in Japan and the killing of Osama bin Laden and on it goes. It was a very pivotal year, but everybody was talking about 2012, but that's not the year with the
fire there. And I consistently said nothing will happen on December 21, 2012, and it didn't. And it was a miscalculation of the energy shift, so to speak, that the real meaning of that shift point, and it's many different meanings of it, but one of the meanings anyway was the activation of the ninth wave. And that happened in 2011. And then suddenly you have that wave of Arab Spring, as you said. You had a world in protest, and protests really were sort of, people were sort of objecting to the kind of rule of dictators and banksters and so forth.
You had Occupy Wall Street, and you had these Spanish protests against the rich and the banks as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So that sort of fitted with this new state of consciousness coming in and making itself known. And that didn't happen in 2012 when this all sort of came to an end. You might say not an end, but it fell down, so to speak. The time of creating a new world wasn't as evident in 2012 as it was in 2011.
Yeah, right. So and just to clarify, I think you mentioned it, but the waves, they come, the former wave doesn't disappear when the new wave comes. So they all exist on top of each other, which means that maybe people can live on different levels at the same time. Is that a correct description?
Absolutely. Yeah. So they're added to each other. It starts within in the beginning. It's only the first wave that's active, and then on top of that is activated the second, and then the third, and then of course when new waves are added, the reality becomes more complex, and they form interference patterns with each other, and then step by step it becomes a much more complicated reality that is creating by all of these waves. But they are added to each other, and where we are now is at a point when all the ninth wave are active. They are in principle, you can connect to them and you can download them. That's really the ninth wave was activated then, but it all goes on. They all run on probably indefinitely, as far as I know.
We will definitely come back to the ninth wave. I was thinking maybe towards the end we can talk about the future and all that, because I mean the ninth wave is very interesting for all of us who are interested in the so-called ascension of humankind, or whatever you want to call it. But let's back up a little bit here and talk about this tiny topic of creation and how everything started and the evolution of all the organisms and the universe as we know it. And then, of course, we have to talk about the first waves there. You said that that humankind emerged as the humans we know it today with the fifth wave. But before that, there were obviously four waves. So everything started with as far as Western science is concerned, everything started with the Big Bang. But according to the Mayans, it even started before the Big Bang. Isn't that right?
Yes, you have to make that conclusion, so to speak. And in their mythologies that we have left, and including the Popol Vuh, for instance, they describe it as if the gods are gathering before a new creation is to begin. And then the gods are sitting there talking about what are we going to do, how are we going to do that. And then they start it. So then it becomes real, you might say. They started by talking, you might say, by creating, by thinking, or however you want to portray it. But then it only becomes physical after they have thought about it, so to speak. That's how they will look upon it.
So, and there's a gestation period then. So when they are...
Yeah. Yeah,
they or whatever it is, consciousness itself or God is thinking about this. It's like, could you then describe the Big Bang as a thought, like as many philosophers have said, almost as if, a human being is a thought in the minds of two lovers before that person is born.
Yes. I think exactly that's how it is. You know, whatever is thinking at that time, as you said, is it God, as we have it in the Judeo-Christian view? Is it a bunch of gods like the Maya, or is it just spirits or energies, so forth? That is beyond, certainly beyond what I can say anything about with certainty. But something was happening before this. There was a plan. This is a whole plan, actually. The plan up until the present time probably existed already at that point in time.
It's like what's inside an acorn. A full oak tree is already within the acorn, and we know that.
Yeah.
There's nothing mystical about that or mysterious about that for most people. Yeah. It is mysterious, really, but most people would find it trivial. But actually, if you think about the universe in the same way, it's kind of fascinating. Why wouldn't it be like that?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Why wouldn't it be like that?
This fact or idea that the universe comes with a plan, is that the reason why the universe is holographic as well? Because this is something you talk about in the book also.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, holographic means that there are, among other things, it means that different levels, different holons, as they call these kind of spherical unities of life, that they exist and are connected from the very largest, which is the entire universe, to the galaxy, down to the solar system, to the Earth, and then down to ourselves. We are holons ourselves. And for a universe to work, function and create what it has created, all of these must be synchronized in a meaningful way. And those synchronizations, I would say, that's what typifies the holographic universe. It has to be that way. If the molecules in our body would not be subordinated to the entire functioning of the human being, for instance, as just one of a million different examples, if they were not subordinated, it wouldn't work. It would soon just go in all kinds of directions, and nothing would come out of creation.
Yeah. Yeah, I tend to agree. I think it's very compelling. And so tell about what you call the tree of life in the book also, which is actually something very, to many people, maybe mundane, which is, it's far from mundane, but it's the universal axis. And this was not discovered until fairly late, I guess. It's kind of a rift in the universe. If you look at the background radiation and all that, you can see that there's a rift. And is this evidence that also that the Big Bang came with a plan that also corresponds with and this is far out, I think, but it's fascinating, the two-sidedness of all higher organisms. Like we have, I mean, we have two arms, two legs, and even two brain halves. We have the left brain and the right brain. And it looks almost, or I was thinking when I read your book about this axis or this tree of life, that it's like the universe, this is the corpus callosum of the whole universe in a way.
Yes.
Dividing the right brain from the left brain of the universe. Is that is that the way you can conceive it?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, it's the concept of tree of life is, you know, most people have heard about it, and certainly every ancient culture and even every indigenous culture revered a tree of life, and you might wonder why would they do that? Why would these independent people? You know, I've been to New Zealand and seen what the Maori would call the tree of life, and I've been to the Maya in Guatemala and seen what they call the tree of life, and I'm from Sweden. And the Vikings would have Yggdrasil, the tree of life, which was really a creator, so to speak, to them. It was actually standing above the gods. The gods would gather every morning under the tree of life in order to have their council and discuss what was going to be done. But it was a sort of a supreme creator in a certain sense. And this, I think, is correct, and is part of the holographic universe, and so that every holon on this level has its own tree of life, and then information or energy or whatever it is, it trickles down and creates the rest of the world down to the more and more microcosmic levels. So, but then, yes, that's the old traditional views. And of course, it played a significant role in the Bible, in the first book of the Bible, in the book of Genesis, and because that's where the snakes would come from, the serpents would come there. And there is a reality to this, though, which is that this tree of life is what generates these waves, the serpents, so to speak, and spreads it across the universe, and in so doing creates the universe. And but then in terms of modern science, it has been then fairly recently, 20 years ago now, it was discovered in when they were studying the afterglow of the Big Bang, the so-called microcosmic background radiation, they found that it wasn't quite uniformly spread across the universe. They found that there was an axis, a central axis throughout the universe, and that axis, as far as we can tell, has existed all the time way to the Big Bang. In other words, it probably was part of creating this whole universe, and especially then the division in two hemispheres, in creating duality, you might say, and creating the left-right brain half duality, the east-west earth duality, etc., etc. And probably without this, nothing would exist, because that's what generates the first structure, as far as we know, that's the first structure, the existence of that axis that I say simply is the same thing as the ancients would talk about as the tree of life. The existence of that is really fundamental to anything existing, because otherwise there wouldn't be any structure in the universe and everything would just be floating around in some kind of a soup of nothingness, or maybe a plasma or something like that.
Yeah, that's a good segue over to my next section here, because a pivotal idea, a pivotal notion in your teaching and the Mayan teaching is that consciousness is primary. Consciousness precedes matter, right? Because as far as I understand, if the gods or the all-encompassing consciousness or whatever you want to call it had this thought about the universe first, precedes, of course, then the Big Bang. And the Big Bang is when matter manifests. Is that the first wave when the Big Bang happens?
Yeah.
That's the first
wave. It's the first wave, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So this means then that evolution is real. Evolution is true.
Yeah.
But it's purposeful. It's not random. Right. And that's also a very crucial
Yes, it's a very crucial point, and it's sort of a controversial point, and a point where established science will fight tooth and nails not to yield, so to speak. Because, you know, I think if they would have to recognize that this Darwinist idea that life is an accident or is a product of accidents, if they had to recognize that would be false, then they would lose a lot of faith to the world, because they've been maintaining so hard. They've been sort of fighting this idea of a god or anything living, so to speak, for a long time. And
But much of the what's happening in the universe and what has taken place in evolution is pretty unexplainable if it weren't for the idea that it actually has a purpose and that there's a thought behind it, and it's living. Yeah. It's a living organism. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Because, for instance, would evolution accelerate if it were random? Would it create ever more advanced organisms? I mean, logically,
no.
Would it?
No, it doesn't. And I also think that it has. We humans are special. It doesn't mean that we're better than the elephants or the rats or anything else, but we are certainly special in this particular scheme. And we're special because it's only with us that there is really this full development of consciousness, which means that, you know, we could not have come into existence by accident, by random mutations, as the dominant paradigm still says. No, we're the product of a number of waves that are directed, and the first wave just produces the monocellular organisms like bacteria and so forth. But then, in a second step, the lower wave always prepares a ground for the next level to develop. And in the next level, the second wave, you have the evolution of animals and plants and fungi and so forth. And you get these bilateral organisms, or at least bilateral animals. And they end up in the mammals. And then the mammals are four-legged, basically. But then on top of that comes the third wave that creates upright standing bipedal organisms, like starting with simple tarsiers or monkeys, and then goes on to the humans or to the big apes that preceded us. And then based on those big apes, then comes the human being, starting with a fairly small brain found in Africa, the Homo habilis, as it's called, and it goes through Homo erectus and a bunch of different other versions of human beings, leading up to the human, to ourselves, the Homo sapiens. And then on top of that, then comes the whole evolution of consciousness that has led to this being that has created these computers we're talking with, and et cetera. That's how it works. They base themselves. The lower wave is always a basis for the next, a support for the next. They would talk about the nine support systems, if you go to the ancient Maya, because it's supporting, every step is supporting the other.
Yeah, this thing about evolution, it's a topic by itself, of course. You could have many episodes around the notion of, or the idea of evolution and how it works and how it does not work and all that. But there are some things that I'm definitely not an expert. I'm a lay person in that respect as well, in that area as well. But there are some things that don't really make sense, or to me at least. Like, I mean, it says that it is the survival of the fittest, maybe not the strongest. I guess Darwin said strongest, but it's been interpreted as the survival of the fittest. But I mean, why change a functioning concept? Why would species evolve from a perfectly functional state and become something different? Because I mean, we have, for instance, I mean, we are supposedly have evolved from other primates, but there are primates that have been here unchanged for millions of years, like chimpanzees and gorillas, not to speak about the crocodiles who have been here for 60 million years completely unchanged, because they're perfectly adapted to their environment. And so why would any species, I mean, even a bacteria could be said to be perfectly adapted to their environment and the fittest of them all in that area, so to speak, if you follow what I mean here.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's a very good point. I mean, there's no reason that there would be an evolution unless there is something that brings that evolution about in a meaningful and a directed way, in a purposeful way. And what does that is these waves that create more and more advanced species in certain regards, and as you say, why would the bacteria want to evolve, or if it was only, why would they evolve if it was just a random product? That's highly unlikely, and it wouldn't happen. But there is, you know, it makes much more sense to say that there is all a plan for the evolution of consciousness, and that plan includes the evolution of biological species brought about by these different waveforms that the Maya described.
Yeah, and then there is, of course, these examples that you also, or these objections to Neo-Darwinist theory that you point out in the book, namely that, for instance, an extreme example would be when a caterpillar transforms into a butterfly, it goes into a chrysalis cocoon, and there it just becomes mush before it changes into some completely different kind of creature. And how would this caterpillar, if it was a, let's say it was a caterpillar from the beginning, and it decided at some point that no, it's probably better to become a butterfly, and in the intermediate time there should be some random experimentation with becoming cocoon here or the other thing there. It just doesn't make sense, does it?
No, it doesn't.
It's very strange.
It really doesn't. It makes much more sense to that to say that we are the result of a purposeful creation.
Yeah, there's a push. There's a a pulse of some kind, the wave, as you said, and
but it's also not that the waves are not just Mayan ideas. I mean, that's also something that you find, almost the serpent as a symbol for these is something you find all over the planet in all kinds of cultures. You have some reverence of the serpent, and including what is now considered the oldest piece of art made by humans in Southern Africa, 70,000 years old. Which is a big serpent. You know, it's been there for, you find them in Göbekli Tepe in present-day Turkey. You find a lot of serpents on their steles. And then you find it all over the world, and certainly you have the biblical story, and which is unique in the sense that it's the only one where the serpent is condemned. It sort of points to an opening to something, a new kind of worldview, maybe more sort of ego-based gods than energies just moving like in serpentine fashions.
Does the Mayan concept of the waves mean that there can, and referring to specifically the sixth wave, which supposedly arrived then 3115 BC, that's right, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes.
So referring to that, does that mean that there cannot have been advanced human civilizations before this one, before the one that emerged around that time? I'm a bit confused here because I'm very interested in the theories about ancient civilizations that have been lost. And aren't the Mayans themselves talking about an earlier period, many, many thousands of years before that? Or am I wrong there?
Well, earlier periods, that's what my book is about. All these waves create earlier periods.
Yeah, but advanced civilizations like...
No, I don't think so. I don't know what that source would be, and yes, I would say so. What this means is that no high tech civilizations could have existed before 5,000 years ago, and that fits with what you know. Actually, the data is fits with what archaeologists find. They never find anything of that kind. And if you know from the Ice Age, for instance, you know if you go back 20,000 years or so, you don't find anything like a house or a pyramid or anything like that. But you do find a lot of things. You do find Stone Age tools and these kind of things. So it's not that we have nothing left from them. And I see no reason to believe in any kind of high-tech civilization prior
like
to that point.
The Atlantis stories, for instance, you don't believe in those?
No, and partly it's just being a scientist. You know, you can't just believe in things if there's no significant evidence in for it. But it also... it doesn't make sense. I mean, the way I look upon evolution is that it's quantized. It's full of, it's created by these quantum waves, so to speak. And then there are quantum leaps that take place between these, which change the states of consciousness. And then people gain a completely different kind of creativity and so forth. But if you don't adhere to a view of the evolution of the universe as being quantized, as being a quantum phenomenon, so to speak, then you will more or less have to fill in the gaps and say, well, how could it be that the Egyptians almost out of nothing created these pyramids and these civilizations in Mesopotamia and Indus Valley and so forth, that they seems to have just popped up out of nowhere. Well, if you believe as I do, or adhere to as I do, in a view of evolution as being quantized, that is exactly what you should expect. You shouldn't expect anything to slowly be going on in the past, developing it. Having said that, you know, it's not that it was nothing before 5,000 years ago. It's just no structured pyramids or cities or so, because that's what was downloaded was then a new geometry of the mind, a structured geometry of the mind, and without that being accessible to people, they couldn't create a pyramid. They couldn't create writing, which really depends very much on straight geometries and so forth. But it's exactly what you would expect, that from a quantum evolution perspective, is that there were no higher civilizations before. Now, higher civilization is a little bit different, though. I can imagine that people earlier on were even more spiritually advanced than we've been there for a long time, because they had that unfiltered state of consciousness that would have allowed for an unbroken connection to the divine or to the creator, so to speak. So I would not say that they were not advanced, because it's not a good word to use, really. But what I'm saying is that they would not be able to do technological advances before 5100, because that's when they get it. And then there is a little bit of a pre-wave, which would then, you know, include, for instance, Göbekli Tepe and a couple of places like that going up to 10,000 years. But before that, nothing of that sort. But they might have been spiritually much more advanced than we are. And that I shouldn't say anything. I actually think they were. I think they were.
Fascinating. Going with your idea and the Mayans ideas here, it does make sense. It does. And you're the second guest I've had in a short time who doesn't believe in the ancient civilization hypothesis. One thing that might change that would be if you came up with you realized that the Mayan calculations wasn't correct here when it comes to the sixth wave, that it was earlier.
Yeah,
something like that. Mm-hmm.
Right.
So we'll see about that.
Yeah, we'll see about that. Yeah.
So yeah. You talked about the quantized evolution here, and quantum physics is very present in your book and in your teaching here. You refer to quantum physics, but you widen it also to the macrocosm. You talk about this macrocosmic quantum theory, MQT. Is it your invention?
Yes, it's my invention.
Okay, and so in what way does the macrocosmic quantum theory tie in with quote-unquote ordinary quantum physics, which deals with only the microcosm, as people are aware of?
Yeah, right. So if you say ordinary quantum theory, or I would refer to as a microcosmic quantum theory, you know, it supposedly only applies to subatomic particles, meaning that it really doesn't have too much to say about human beings or our states of consciousness or something like that. The macrocosmic quantum theory that I develop here is based then on the Mayan calendar system, but also then all the empirical evidence that tends to support that kind of a system, that you can see, you can track and see how whenever there is a peak, there is something new emerging. And then when there ever is a valley, there is some kind of a reaction to that, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of empirical evidence that these waves that the Maya described are real. But then there are similarities. For one thing, you know, these are waves. Whether you're on the microcosmic level or the macrocosmic level, there are waves. And what I also talk about is that there is, you know, there is a periodic system in chemistry which is based on quantum theory, and here you have a periodic system of evolution which is based on macrocosmic quantum theory, and there are similarities and connections between these. There is, for instance, the phenomenon of entanglement that is significant. I think Schrödinger, who is, you know, one of the big pioneers of quantum theory, he would talk about entanglement of different particles as the most important aspect of quantum theory. And what entanglement means is that if you have two particles that are in that have been created together and it has a common quantum state, then they will forever, or at least regardless of how far they move from each other, out in this, you know, light years away from each other, they will be entangled, so that if the state of one of them changes simultaneously, exactly simultaneously, instantaneously, the other particle will also change, meaning that somehow they are connected regardless of the distances of each other. And what I'm talking about here is the holographic universe, which is really also based on, it's not particles, but it's like holons, these big spheres that define the states of consciousness on each of our parts. And they are similarly connected on different levels of the universe. So you have that phenomenon on macrocosmic and microcosmic level of entanglement. But this is not something, the macrocosmic quantum theory is not something accepted by official science. And it has to do with simply the perspective of reductionism that modern science still basically operates according to. You know, everything, they try to explain everything from below to above. So, for instance, Darwinism is an example of that, where they try to explain the whole body plan of an elephant or something like that with something smaller, with something in the DNA. Whereas my perspective is the other way around, essentially, as above, so below, so that whatever we have here on Earth, it is a reflection of much larger structures. And these connections between them are entangled. And there are several other parallels. You can look at how the microcosmos and the macrocosmos would be connected, would be entangled. But I won't go into that now.
You have a fantastic picture, or two parallel pictures in the book showing what the neurons in the brain look like, and compare them to what the structure of the nebulae, if that's the word in plural, in the in faraway galaxies or faraway parts of the space look like. They look identical, practically.
Yeah. No, that's right. That's a very good example. It's sort of coming back to the same kind of structure.
And two human beings can be entangled, I suppose, in a way that would explain telepathy, for instance.
Yeah. And we do experience telepathy, so to speak. I mean, telepathy is such a big word, so to speak, and as if you can read immediately the total mind of somebody else. But, you know, if you and I started talking about our personal histories, we would very soon sort of just come to these points where we have commonalities. And you do that whenever you meet somebody at a party or whatever. It takes a minute or two and you find that, oh, you were there too. And the most unlikely things come back. And how did that happen? Well, it happened through some kind of a telepathy where somehow you just resonate with something of that person. It doesn't happen with every person, but it happens it would be very unlikely if it were not some kind of an operating telepathically like that creates for us discovering all these commonalities that we will have.
Yes, and we have all these synchronicities that are also fascinating, happen all the time. When you meet somebody three times a day that you haven't met in several years, for instance, and you instantly sense that there must be some point to this, there must be some purpose to this.
Yeah. So, and that's not a material phenomenon. It's a phenomenon of consciousness synchronicity or consciousness telepathy, you might say. I would say.
Yeah, I agree. Consciousness is primary, is driving the whole thing. So you mentioned the principle of as above, so below, or as below, so above, many times already here and also in the book. And that leads me to asking whether other traditions, other ancient texts fit in with this narrative, because this principle of as above, so below is, of course, the second Hermetic principle, and it is believed that the Hermetic principles or Hermetica comes from ancient Egyptian tradition and also goes over to the Greeks, and the Greek, conveyed it further over to the Romans and so forth. So do those Egyptian wisdoms, those Egyptian texts fit into this model, and also maybe the ancient Indian Vedic texts, for instance? What do you say? Do they tie in with this?
Yeah, I would say that all of those, all of the above, so to speak. I think I, for instance, believe in Robert Boval's theory about the Orions being reflected in the pyramids of Giza.
The Orion's belts, as the three pyramids.
And I've studied star maps that people in many different parts of the world would create, that are how on Earth where they were, they created earthworks that would be reproducing what they saw in the sky, so to speak. Like I would also argue that the three mounts in Uppsala in Sweden are really the three belt stars as well, and many, many other things like that. But just in general, you know, all of this tells us that the ancient peoples, they were directed towards the skies, towards the cosmos in many different ways. And why would they be that? Well, I would say it is because the creative source is cosmic, is this cosmic consciousness. And then whatever it creates then trickles down through the different levels and come down to the human beings. And the human beings then want to, at least in ancient times, they want to create heaven on earth. They want to reproduce what the world was like up in the divine heavens. So I think you find that all across the planet. I found many different star maps similar to Boval's idea when it comes to Egypt. So it's widespread. But then the question is, what sets the Maya apart? And I think I'd like to say something about that, which is that most of their cosmology, most of the Mayan cosmology, as well as other Mesoamerican people's cosmologies, are shared all over the world. Serpents and trees of life, and as above, so below, and yin and yang, and all kinds of things. There was an ancient mind, the mind at an earlier point before the seventh and the eighth and the ninth wave had been activated, had similarities all across the planet. The only thing that sets the Maya apart, and which led me to specifically focus on it and study it, is the fact that they have calendars. And calendars means numbers. And if you have numbers, you have also a potential connection to what we in modern times now think of as science, so to speak. You can verify things when you have numbers. But other than that, you will find across the world, you will find many similarities in the cosmologies that ancient peoples would have.
Mm. So you know that many think that the reason why there are so many similarities around the world and so many megalithic structures that look almost the same or are similar in different on different continents that supposedly did not have any contact with each other, is the reason for that, many think, is that there was an earlier global civilization that could convey this knowledge. But what you're saying is that this happened, this is the case, because humankind downloaded simultaneously a higher level of consciousness and were suddenly able to create these kinds of buildings, for instance, geometrically speaking and mathematically speaking and all that, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, the new state of consciousness, the sixth wave that had that duality between the left and the right brain half and the geometric structure, that was downloadable all across the planet at the same time. It just came. And then that's why you have pyramids from that time in Peru and in Mongolia at the same time as it is from in Egypt and Mesopotamia. So it came down. Now, it didn't come everywhere, so to speak. And the reason is that there is also this download of a new mind. It has to interact with a reality on Earth, so to speak. So, say, for instance, in Scandinavia, people didn't build any pyramids 5,000 years ago. And the reason is that they had their agriculture was very, very limited. And, you know, there was not millions of people you had in Egypt. Because they had the good sources of agriculture developed since many years and so forth. And so there are physical factors that play in, that limits, that makes it, it's not everywhere that people started to create civilizations 5,000 years ago. But it is. It did happen simultaneously in those places where there is reasonable physical conditions for that to happen.
Indian tradition or the Vedic tradition or wherever it comes from, I think it's from there, you have the idea of the chakras. And I was thinking maybe the chakras correspond to these waves in certain waves that each wave corresponds to a chakra, and it's the chakras are thought of as the lower ones being, you know, the root chakra being the lowest one, and then the crown chakra being the highest one. But there are only seven. Seven. So have you thought about this?
Yeah, I certainly have. Seven is the traditional, and I think there was a time even that when there were only four of them, if I recall correctly. But then
so maybe there are nine, after all.
Yeah, If you go to look at the images of chakras on the internet, you will find there are some people that have like I think 12, uh-huh. and then some of those chakras are not even connected to the physical body, but it's sort of above us. I think that's a whole field of. I think you're on track on the right thing there, I don't want to give an answer because I don't have those kind of clairvoyant abilities to see chakras or so. But
it would be plausible that
it's a plausible thing.
Yeah,
it's,
waves correspond to the body in some ways. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And that new abilities do occur with new waves. So why not?
Yeah. What about other things like astrology? Does that tie in with this line of thought?
No, it doesn't. And you come to another place where sort of where is the evidence? I think this is what I present in my book for the Mayan calendar is evidence. In other words, you have you can match things. You can match the waves to events to the history of humankind. You can of the history of the universe. So when it comes to I've been looking always. I've been always asking for people that are into astrology. Where is the evidence? What is this based on? And I've never gotten any answer. So I personally take no interest in astrology. I haven't, it doesn't fit my own. No. I can say that for sure. I'm supposed to be a Taurus, they say, which means you're supposed to be very conservative. You never move around, and you're very materialistic, and et cetera, et cetera. And I'm kind of the opposite of all of those things, and so I wonder why would I believe in it?
Well, the chart is more complicated than that, as you know, probably.
Yeah, I probably. But anyway. It doesn't tie in with this
Mayan
theory
or anything like that.
No, there's no direct connection, so to speak. There's not.
So, just one more of those before I leave those alternative.
Okay.
I was thinking about reincarnation. Is anything said about that?
I think you mean from a Mayan perspective.
Yes, from a Mayan perspective.
Yeah, I think so. You know, there is certainly there's a famous tomb in Palenque. The king Pakal is dead. And he's under his sarcophagus, and the lid of that sarcophagus, there is a picture of him at death because he's dying. He's falling into the roots of the world tree. But then you have all these examples also of us human beings being reflections of the world tree. And it seems like they had some kind of an idea that at death you would go to the world tree, but then you could be recycled, so to speak, and go back to through the world tree and come back to our own planet or somewhere else. I can't tell. But it sounds like overall, there are not texts from the Maya that are straight explicatory, so to speak. There's nothing like that to find. But you can make a case, I think, that they did believe in some form of reincarnation.
Mm. Okay, so let's go back to or forward to the future again. We mentioned, we early on in the conversation talked about the ninth wave, which arrived around 2011. And we have already agreed that was a very pivotal year and many things happened. So what's going to happen now when we have this ninth wave in place and all the other eight waves are also in place at the same time?
Right.
So what are we looking at here? Is it a complex interference between all the nine waves? And Are we facing a split humanity, perhaps? Many people talk about the polarization that's going on right now. What do you think, where do you think we are heading with this ninth wave in place?
Yeah. But also then, it's not only the ninth wave, but it's also the other waves. They are still in operation, so to speak. Yeah. And meaning that they are contributing to our situation overall. And what happened also in 2011 wasn't just, you know, in March of 2011, the ninth wave was activated, and it was the last highest wave that was activated. But then in late October 28th in 2011, all of these waves that had been in like peaks, they turned into valleys. And so, meaning you could talk about them as being dark ages. And because they have different frequencies, and they also have different periods, or you say length of the periods that they describe, and meaning that the interference patterns become quite complex. Well, let me just backtrack a little bit. This is what it sort of looks like: how the peaks alternate with the valleys, or you could talk about them as light and darkness, or light ages and dark ages. Certainly, if you study history, you will find that there are creative phases, and there are not so creative or even destructive phases that's there. And this is the sixth wave, the one that has created civilizations and then was activated about 5,000 years ago. And then if you study that, if you follow that, you will see that every time a new peak begins, there will be an activation, or has been a major empire will emerge along this line. And an empire is a part of a creativity of creating connections on a larger level that than existed previously. But then when these turn into valleys or nights, there's usually a collapse of these different empires. So here, for instance, 1144 BC, you have the Bronze Age collapse, which meant all of these. There was a collapse of Eastern Mediterranean empires or cultures, civilizations. And here you have the collapse of the 355 BC, you have the collapse of Alexander's empire based on the Persian Empire that had been the biggest in the world then. And then you have 434, you have the collapse of the West Roman Empire, and not as markedly maybe, but at the end of the sixth day, you had the collapse of most of the more advanced Native American cultures. The post-classical Maya collapsed, the Cahokia collapsed, Mesa Verde collapsed. All of these places, they come to an end. And we're now at a similar place, a point in time. And what that means is that I do expect some kind of a collapse of the, at least of the Western world, and certainly the Western dominance of the world is about to come to an end.
So this is because of a valley in the sixth wave, but on top of that, right, we have two other waves or three other waves that we can access, but we are still affected by the sixth wave valley there.
Very much, yeah.
Okay, I understand.
That's right, yeah. Now, when it comes to the seventh wave, then, if we go back here, the wave that created not only not only industries, but also the wave that actually created democracy and the idea of freedom for everyone. That those kind of ideas were not around until the so-called Enlightenment in Europe in the mid-1700s. You know, nobody before that were really seriously thinking of, you know, deposing the kings or the monarchies. But then that started to happen because there was a shift. The duality that had dominated the monarchies or the states of consciousness of people in monarchies, that came to an end. And then that particular wave, it also goes into a dark age in 2011 by the end of it. But then the difference there is that we're still in that, but then in 2031 it will sort of come back we're in a time then in a dark age in this particular wave, which is typical of favoring autocratic ideas and autocratic structures and so forth. But then in 2031, we'll come back to a light age in that particular time, meaning that there might be some kind of a restructuring of the world where those ideals that, you know, formed this particular wave, the ideals of freedom and democracy may come back and become much more prominent, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's a complex pattern here. You might also add that in 2031, that's 20 years after the first nine wavers were born, the first ones born into the nine waves. And meaning that, you know, even if you and I, we may also have aspects of ourselves that are more higher consciousness, more ascended, so to speak. At least I wasn't born into that reality, and meaning that I haven't taken it down as a full download, I would say. But then it will be easier for that generation, I think, and that will sort of, they will be able to create more of an heaven on earth, so to speak. But I expect this time until then to be very, very difficult. I've also thought that, you know, maybe there'll be some kind of a global dictatorship where the U.S. of Trump comes together with Putin and Xi or something like that. And then, which, you know, is a unification in a sense, but then really from top down determined everything, so to speak. But then in 2031, I think there will be because of that particular wave, there will be a reaction against all this control and so forth that is being developed by many parts of the world as the current time. And then people would react to it and free themselves and recreate a new world in a sense, because, you know, if there is a global dictatorship, then the nation states will kind of disappear with that, and all the competition with the different nations would come to an end in a sense. But then based on that, there could be then a shift. So it's really, my view here is not at all a linear thing. It's not like just looking at what is happening now and then think that that's going to happen also tomorrow. That's one of the key lessons from the Mayan calendar, is that history is not linear. It is wave-like. It is like a pendulum swinging in different directions. So anyway,
maybe like a spiral a little bit.
It
mimics itself, but on a higher level each time.
Yeah, so. yeah, It is all operating according to a spiralic movement. You know, the shifts in states of consciousness that you saw on with the picture with the pyramid there, they are moving in a spiral way. They're actually rotating these dualities, and that rotation is coordinated with a movement upwards, so to speak, and that is what you could call a spiralic movement.
Yeah. But hopeful future, if we just wait a few years, maybe like 6 or 7 years more, if we can make it through that difficult period, there is hope on the horizon.
Well, I would think this is how it is planned, so to speak. But then it's the question, you know, are human beings acting the most appropriate way in order to this happen? And probably it's not something for that we can just wait for. But we'll still have to prepare for, and we will have to, including working with ourselves, as it says. And that working with ourselves is to a large extent, it's about no longer projecting those states of consciousness. That means that you project darkness onto others, which is really the basis of blame and all that history, so to speak. So I do think it really will require that hope that I can see. You know, I don't know how bad it will be in the next couple of years, but, you know, I'm not the only one that is seeing this as a very difficult and dark period coming. And in fact, I would think a lot of people are seeing that. But on the other hand, what the Mayan calendar tells us is that there is a plan, and the plan is not for us to be, what should I say, suppressed or so. The plan is ascension, as some people would call it, and you mentioned earlier, so to speak. It is a sort of a reconnection to the cosmic consciousness that have been lost through some of these filters that had led us up to the present time. Mm-hmm. And then the ninth wave plays a significant role in this, because it tells us that there is that direction towards that's where we're meant to go. It's the highest level, and you can follow the ninth wave see, which is just a 36 day period, and then you will feel the difference in the periods that are peaks and the periods that are valleys, but ultimately that is what drives us, and this is the highest wave. The highest wave also means the highest frequency. It means it moves with the highest rate of change going on. Together, you know, I do think that there is such a plan from the cosmos for a world in peace and love and unity.
Some people would call that the age of Aquarius, but you wouldn't call it that.
Some people would call it that. Yes, there are many people.
It's nice, that we have the same vision there, but no matter what you call it.
Yeah. No, that's right.
So, fascinating stuff. You truly have come up with a theory of everything, as you also speak about in the book. And it's a tall order, but I mean, I think that what you are describing there is actually a theory of everything. And it's, as you point out also, it's not possible to summarize that theory with equations like the modern scientists like to do, but maybe more like a symbol like this I have here around my...
Yeah. Oh, okay. Beautiful. The tree of life.
Tree of life. Yeah. Maybe it can be symbolized by the tree of life, that theory of everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, Carl Johan, where can people go now to find out more about you and this fascinating work that you're doing?
Well, I recommend my own webpage, kalleman.com, kalleman.com. And then there are books available. There you see my books, and then you can go to amazon.com or Amazon in any country, and then you could just go by my name and find those books. Then sometimes, you know, you can sign up for, I don't really have a regular newsletter, but I do have courses, and you can sign up for those online on my website.
Fantastic. And I'll put links in the
thank you.
Show notes.
Thank you.
As always. So thank you so much for sharing
thank
your
you.
Knowledge and insights, and good luck with your fascinating exploration.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I enjoyed it. Thank you very much for having me.
My pleasure. If you like this video, don't forget to subscribe and don't forget to hit that like button and share the video with your friends. Please support the channel if you can. I appreciate all the support. You can become a Patreon for as little as $1 a month, or you can make a one-off donation via PayPal if you wish. All the links are in the description box below. Thank you.